session number 11338, reel 6.
Wing Commander Alec Ingle, Reel 6. Reel 6.
The Sayer 1 day, it was quite warm and sunny. The Italians were at play in this pond, and the Russians decided they'd have some sports. A sport too, so they tossed a couple of hand grenades into the thing, and of course the Italians came out very rapidly, followed by quite a lot of dead fish. But the Russians had a very light-hearted approach to weapons, because if you were walking through the camp and a Russian wanted to attract your attention, he didn't shout or anything like that, he just fired a burst of automatic fire over your head. And fortunately, no one was killed doing this. And then they also, some odd habits. I was the Russian liaison officer of the camp, and some of our people came to me one day and said they'd been in the camp and some Russian soldiers had surrounded them and taken their watches. So I got hold of the German camp commandant and said, look, this isn't very good, what can you do about it? So he said, leave it with me. The next thing I knew, I was summoned to see him, and he had a number of Russians with him, and said, well, are these the watches we're talking about? So I said, would appear to be so. And he said, well, that's all right. I propose to shoot these people. So he took quite a lot of persuading that we wouldn't regard it as a very friendly or helpful gesture if he shot them, so eventually he disposed of them somehow or other. But I think he was quite genuine, that he was quite prepared to shoot them to show us that, as gallant allies, the Russians were quite keen that our rights should be properly protected. In fact, the Russians had not a very odd approach, I suppose, a very sensible approach from their point of view. They only regarded three people as being in the war: the Anglo-Americans and the Russians, and anything else. They were prepared to tolerate the Yugoslavs. The Yugoslavs in the camp, they thought, were quite good. The Italians, they just ignored completely, wouldn't even provide food for them. And so that whenever there was a difficult situation, all you had to do was to call on the great entente between the three great powers, and that generally ended any argument or discussion. You know, you'd had to make them feel that they were really letting the side down if they got very difficult with us, because they could be very obstreperous.
Could they?
Yes, they could be very difficult. There was a man called General Famina, who had some position of authority. He was a very frozen-faced gentleman. And he used to appear in the camp with his entourage, great ceremony, and summon us. And we had to go along and listen to him with our interpreters and things. And he could be very, very difficult indeed. And his habit usually was to turn up about 2 o'clock in the morning and summon you, and then keep you standing around whilst he talked or he harangued you for several hours, and then he'd go away again. He got very excited, because after a time, of course, people got very bored with being in the camp, and they knew the Americans were only about 30 miles away on the Elbe, so they thought it'd be a good idea to drift off. And, of course, the Russians kept picking them up and bringing them back. Whether they brought them all back, I don't know. But anyhow, obviously the frontline troops were objecting to all these prisoners going through the lines, and they'd protested to Famina, and he got very upset with us, couldn't understand why we couldn't keep our people under firm control and prevent them from, in fact, walking away from the camp. We had to point out that they didn't see any reason why they should be kept in the camp, particularly as at that time the war had ended, and they wanted to go home. He did threaten to say, oh, well, we'll send you home via Odessa, which was apparently the route for the evacuation of prisoners, Allied prisoners, which had been agreed at Yalta. But we weren't very enthusiastic about going to Odessa. We visualized another few weeks' wait before we ever got home, so we stuck it out. He also got very difficult with the Norwegians. We had this the Norwegian general staff under General Ruger in the camp, and their idea was that they'd ship these rather elderly gentlemen up to Murmansk, and they could fight their way back and retake Norway, well, drive the Germans out. We said we didn't think this was a very good thing, and but they were getting very insistent on this. So de Collard talked very hard and very fast, and they were eventually persuaded that wasn't a very good idea either. We had some other odd problems. Quite a lot of the people got her out of the camp and got in touch with German women, and the German women saw this was an opportunity to perhaps get some protection from the Russians, because the Russians were treating them in a fairly beastly fashion from all the reports we got. And they persuaded the some of these prisoners who had been locked up for a long time to marry the girls. And they used to go along to the local, the German town mayor in Luckenwalde and get themselves married. That presented some complications, but the Russians probably had the last laugh, because when they finally shipped us out, they refused to let these people go, because they said they couldn't let them go and leave their wives behind, so they'd got to stay with their wives until such time as they could be repatriated under some arrangement that had been made for displaced foreign persons. But quite a number of people did in fact marry German girls. I think some of it was out of sympathy for the plight they were in. Yeah, but quite a lot of it was for other reasons too. We got a lot of evacuees approaching the camp, because when the Germans had gone, somebody ran up an RAF ensign from an old RAF officer's shirt and one thing or another, and that was hoisted over the gate, and people saw that, and anybody who had the slightest pretension to have connection with the British or the Americans appeared on the scene and asked for sanctuary. And of course some of them who were genuine, there were quite a lot of British wives there, very pleasant people who, you know, stayed there throughout the war with their husbands, and they were in a very difficult position. And whenever I used to go into Luckenwalde, I had a car with a which we'd appropriated with an RAF ensign on it. When I went into the town to see the town major, when I came out, there was always a huge collection of people around the car seeking sanctuary. And it did become quite an embarrassment, and we must have accommodated some thousands of more people in the camp from the time the Germans left. I think probably we went up from about 20 to 25,000 people in the camp.
The English women, would these have been English women sort of caught in that area of Germany when war broke out?
Well, English women married to Germans. And there were some very, very nice people. I was terribly sorry. You couldn't help but be sorry for them. You couldn't help but be sorry for some of these Germans. You see, we had a German mother, a very well-educated woman, very, very pleasant woman, and she had a very attractive daughter. And she said, you know, the rape and pillage that's going on, I must protect my daughter. And it gets very difficult. And they... It really is a very difficult situation. And then, of course, the Russians, I think they'd had their own methods of handling things, because I can recall being in the town one day and hearing a great fusillade of shots, and said to the town major, "What's going on?" He said, "That's none of your business. We're just looking after our affairs." But they were pretty ruthless, because when they arrived in the camp, the frontline troops were all right. They came and went, and they were jolly nice people. But when the second line people arrived, they got hold of all the Russians in the camp and tied a bit of red ribbon around their sleeves and gave them a gun and told them Berlin was that way and start heading for Berlin and fighting. Well, the poor devils could barely walk. They hadn't their feet were wrapped up in rags. They had no shoes and that sort of thing. They were in a deplorable state, but the Russian just drove them out and said, "They are." And within a matter of hours, after they'd decided to ship them out, there wasn't a single Russian left in the camp, but a single Russian prisoner left in the camp. They all just went, poor devils, because they weren't in a fit state to do anything, from what I could see. After a time, our Captain Medvedev fell out with the General Famine, I think, and they brought another man in, Major Kotov, who was a cavalry officer about 5 foot four high, who wore spurs all the time. He was a very, very officious little man and not very cooperative. But I suppose he had his ways. The Americans in particular were getting very restless that we were still in the camp, and we'd heard the war was over. The Russians had acknowledged a couple of days later that the war was over, but we still couldn't get across the Americans, who we knew were only 30 miles away. And there was American, we had a West Point, no, not a West Point, an American, we had a West Point American lieutenant colonel and a commissioned top sergeant lieutenant colonel. Well, the West Point man was very quiet, and he kept in the background, but the promoted top sergeant, he was a somewhat aggressive little man. So he demanded that he should talk to the Russians. So I said, "All right." I organized a meeting for him with the Russians. And a very aggressive, and supplied him with an interpreter, and a very aggressive lieutenant colonel went in, and a very, very subdued top sergeant came out. How Kotov had done it, I don't know, but we had no more trouble then. Anyhow, we kept the camp going. The foraging parties went out. We kept as good order as we could. We kept people as fed as we could. I think, from what I can recall, we had a bit of difficulty with our communications. The Russians were mad keen that we shouldn't have any radio sets, any transmitters, and they searched the camp for transmitters. But we had one. But I don't know whether it was very successful, because we never succeeded, as far as I could tell, in getting our plight across to the... We could never get any acknowledgement from the British side or from the American side that they'd heard that we were there. But various correspondents came through on the way to Berlin, and we gave them letters, and certainly a letter I gave to one of the correspondents eventually arrived back home. So I think our plight must have been known, but the Russians just wouldn't let us go.
Did you wonder why? You know, were you...
Well, we thought it was a bit sinister, to tell you the truth. We couldn't understand ourselves, because the Americans were so close. They'd sent in a convoy of ambulances, the Americans, and these had got through, and all the sick had been taken away. They sent in another convoy of trucks, and some of the Americans got away on it. And they sent in a third convoy, and the Russians turned it back and said if it didn't go back, they'd use armor to turn it back. They got quite aggressive, and just kept sitting on us, wouldn't let us go at all.
Were you able to sort of raise this, you know, as liaison officer with the Russians?
It didn't get us anywhere. It was higher orders. Orders from above, and that's all you could get. Okay. And
Did you know anything about the Yalta Agreement at that stage? Would
well,
you have heard of that?
They'd told us of this Yalta Agreement. The Russians had told us of that, and they told us about Odessa. And we'd had reports by devious means that that's how the prisoners were to be got out at the end of the war. And in fact, some of the people who broke away from the march between Sagan and Luckenwalde, or Balerion Luckenwalde, Bob Tuck, for example, he left on the march and disappeared towards the Russian lines, and he does appear to have got through them, because he wound up in Odessa and came back from Odessa. I don't think he was home any earlier than we were, but it certainly seemed to me there was... We certainly had no wish or inclination to head to the east. We wanted to head west. This was, you know, where home and beauty was.
Did they mention the issue of their own people to be repatriated to you at any stage?
Never mentioned. Curious people, as I understood it, they had no record of anybody below the rank of major. The rest were just troops, and they didn't appear to keep any records. They had placed absolutely no value on human life. That was patently obvious. But they could be very nice, and certainly we were impressed by the frontline troops. They were very good people to deal with. But the second line people and the political men they put in and that sort of thing, Not very good.
How about your Russian? Were you able to speak to them?
Yes, I had a team of interpreters. Some odd one, very good, but enough to get by. One particular man who, I think he must have been, well, I too had been brought up in Russia. One had been, he was born in Russia, I think. He was part of the... His father, I think, was one of the Metvik men after the First World War. That I think we had a lot of trouble with the Russians over the Metvik contracts. Another was one. He was an aircrew man, and he spoke absolutely fluent Russian. And of course, I didn't know any except that. I always found it quite interesting. I'd go to these meetings and say something, and the interpreter would start, "Peridaiti Potpolkovnik Tak." Well, I listened to this for a long time, and eventually I said to the interpreter, "Well, you know, what is it you're telling this man?" He said, "Well, this is the way you start, 'Thus speaks the little colonel.'" So I felt suitably deflated. There was no great problem in communication. We didn't have to communicate with them a lot. You see, we were organized, and I think this rather took them by surprise, so they left us to our own devices. We'd organized ourselves, so they let us get on with it. They were as helpful as they could be, I suppose, except they'd funny ideas about the food we wanted, so we had to do quite a lot from our own devices, our own foraging parties, and of course the Germans were perhaps a little bit reluctant to part with their stocks of grain and flour and that sort of thing. But the foragers seemed to be very successful. And then, of course, we got some quite good forgers in the camp, so that we soon found out what stamps the Russian use, you know, for their documents to get all this sort of stuff. And the forgers soon whipped up a collection of stamps that looked quite official, and they were able to go out and get stuff. We had quite a large intelligence staff who took over all the records from the Kommandantura when we got in there, and being Germans, they'd got very, very detailed records of everything. and they, I think they collected a very considerable quantity and brought them back after the war. We carried a when we moved out, we took a thing with it about the size of a coffin, a box full of German records, I think some of which were used at the subsequent Nuremberg war trials. I think they had the instruction from Himmler about our possible disposal, that sort of thing. And I think they did take quite a bit of valuable information back. But the in the end, they eventually decided they'd let us go. And
because I think now you're leading up to yes. your own repatriation,
yes.
aren't you?
Yes. Okay, fire him up again and we'll... Oh, it's going.
It's going,
oh,
yes.
Oh, you can cut that bit out, can you? Eventually they said we were going to go and they had all sorts of things. They wanted to know everybody's name and address and what was the name of their paternal grandfather and a whole mass of information, and so they had records. They really wanted to produce a record and get a signature for us, I think. And of course, the troops were getting a bit Barbary by this time, so they organised a routine, and about the same 36 people used to keep trooping round and just giving them different names. And they kept this up for practically a whole day, so the Russians had 1,000 or so names, and Anna was satisfied. Nobody could understand really why they wanted to know what the name of the paternal grandfather was, but it seemed to have some interest in the Russians. The day came when they said, we're going to ship you out. So we piled on board a lot of Russian trucks. This is when they made it very clear to the people who'd married the local German women that they weren't coming. And we set off towards the Elbe, towards Halle. And we got to it was quite a difficult run because, of course, a lot of the bridges, particularly where we had to go on a bit of the Autobahn, the bridges were blown. And you left the Autobahn, disappeared down into a gorge, climbed up the other side, and carried on. We got to the Elbe at a place called Coswig, where the Americans had thrown a pontoon bridge across, and we were decanted out of the Russian trucks, and we walked across the pontoon bridge, and the Americans were there to receive us, and I must say we were highly relieved. They took us to Halle-Leipzig airfield, which was some sort of American headquarters. We were well received, and they tried to give us a bit more kit and stuff because we're in a pretty scruffy state. And they fed us, and the American general there apparently had been quite concerned. He'd heard that we were there, but he had a Russian liaison man with him, and the Russian liaison man kept reassuring him that there weren't any more Allied prisoners, the other side of the Elbe. And so some of us had to have dinner with the general that night, with the Russian present, so that the general could make it very clear that these were the people who he'd been talking about for quite some time, and here they were, and they'd not mysteriously appeared. They had been sitting on the Russian side, and what had the Russians been doing about it? Anyhow, that was his particular problem. Our problem was getting home. So we were loaded on board aircraft the following day and flown to Brussels-Evere. When we got to Brussels-Evere, we decanted out of the American aircraft and climbed into some British ones, and we were flown to Dunsfold. When we got to Dunsfold, we'd made ourselves as tidy as we could do, and we thought we were a pretty smart lot. We were all washed, shaved, clean, and hairbrushed, and that sort of thing. The first thing they did when we got to Dunsfold was to make us lie down on a bed and then squirt DDT up our trouser legs and down our arm or down our sleeves. So we came out looking like, well, millers, I suppose, covered with flour. They then gave us a cup of tea and a bun. I think the Red Cross did that. And they gave us a pound and a railway warrant. And transport to Guildford Station. There we got to Guildford Station. It was funny watching people with a pound. One character, very serious gentleman, the first thing he did was go to the bookstall and buy himself a good book. I think other people tended to go and have a drink with it. I suppose we crossed London. I can't remember crossing London. But we went to Cosford, which is west of Wolverhampton, the RAF station at Cosford, which was to be the prisoners' reception centre there. We arrived there quite late at night, and we had a meal and went to bed. And the following morning, we got a bit more kit, so at least we could go home looking presentable. As far as I was concerned, I wrote out a combat report, trying to remember what had happened practically 2 years before. And then we were given double ration cards, I think, for 6 weeks. 6 weeks. I think we were allowed 6 weeks leave with double rations. And we were sent on our way rejoicing. Very relieved to be back. It was very interesting because my wife later was talking about this, and she said, when I got home, I didn't stop talking for 3 days. I just had to get all this out of my system. But I'd bought a dinghy whilst I was in prison camp from a fellow prisoner, and I was anxious to get hold of this dinghy and go sailing, and it duly arrived in a truck, railway truck. So I then took myself off to the local stretch of water at Winsford and entertain myself sailing. Tate.
Yes. I was wondering, when you think of your POW experience, have you had sort of any lasting effects on your life? Do you think you have gained anything from the experience, or on the other hand, lost out because of it?
I think after an experience like that, you must gain an awful lot. You learn an awful lot about your fellow human beings, warts and all. You develop a new philosophy because you've almost hit the bottom, and you're still there and bouncing back. You've been subject to all sorts of indignities. You've been in impossible and extremely hazardous situations, and you can't but fail to be affected by it. And I found you got very philosophical about things. You certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I've come to the conclusion that there isn't such a thing as an impossible situation. Something will turn up. If you keep going long enough, something will turn up. And I'm amazed at the versatility of humans. In that prison camp, there was nothing that couldn't be tackled by somebody in the camp. Now, you've got a collection of relatively young men there, quite well-educated young men, but the talent was absolutely incredible. They were capable of anything. So that there's never any question of defeatism or anything like that. And, I suppose that it influenced me. I don't know whether it influenced everybody else, but certainly as far as I was concerned, it gave me a very considerably different outlook on life. It's had its odd sides. The thing about Germany, and the thing that sticks in my mind more than anything else, is the toilet arrangements. their loos, their lavatories, their aborts. I don't know why it is. I can, if I have a bad dream about Germany, they all seem to come in it, into it. It's amazing. Everything was so crude, and I don't know. It used to give me the shudders. The arrangements were very basic, very simple. They just had a large trough with a chunk of wood on top of it with holes in it, and you sat on that, and that was it. There was nothing like, certainly in the camps, there was nothing like flushing loos or anything like that. There was just this basic sort of 24-holer or whatever you like to call it. It had its funny side at times, particularly at Luckenwalde, at Luckenwalde, because there...